invade Greenland? What will happen? What should we do? Are we going to send troops there?
What do Americans think about the moral standing of the U.S. today? A new NPR Ipsos poll gives us some answers.
For Friday, January 9th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. For more than 20 million Americans, the new year brought with it more expensive health insurance.
They relied on Affordable Care Act subsidies, which have now expired.
I was right around $560 a month. This year, I'm looking at a $940 monthly premium.
And our colleagues from NPR's Shortwave podcast dig into new science stories,
including how elephants' noses guide them in the wild.
Animals don't just randomly hope to find food. And so our question really was an idea of, well, do they use the amount of food as a cue?
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump met with more than a dozen oil executives at the White House this afternoon to talk about the future of oil production in Venezuela. If the company struck a deal, he said they'd be in Venezuela for a long time. NPR's Camilla Domonoski reports.
President Trump made it clear what he wanted.
Our giant oil companies will be spending at least $100 billion of their money, not the government's money. They don't need government money. But they need government protection.
And if any companies didn't want to invest, he said other companies would be willing to take their place. But the gathered executives didn't promise any dollar figures. Darren Woods, the CEO of ExxonMobil, said that after having had assets seized twice in Venezuela, it would take some significant changes before they went back in. As it is today, he called Venezuela uninvestable. Camilla Domonoski, NPR News.
Minnesota officials are asking the public to share any video or other evidence about the fatal shooting of Renee Good by an immigration agent. They say they're concerned by the Trump administration's decision to keep the investigation into the killing in federal hands. During a press conference, Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey says federal officials have already made their own conclusions about the case.
This is not a time to hide from the facts. This is a time to embrace them, making sure that we're pushing for transparency every step of the way. The fact that Pam Bondi's Department of Justice and this presidential administration has already come to a conclusion about those facts is deeply concerning.
The Trump administration insists that the officer who shot the 37-year-old mother of three has complete legal immunity. Meanwhile, Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent says his agency is taking a closer look at financial transactions between Minnesota residents and businesses and Somalia. Somali leaders and local officials have vowed to protect the community. The latest unemployment numbers from the Labor Department show hiring in the U.S. slowed last month. NPR's Scott Horsley says employers added 50,000 jobs during the month.
Healthcare and hospitality were among the few industries to add workers in December. Factories, construction companies, and business services all cut back on employment. Even retailers cut 25,000 jobs in December as stores relied on fewer workers during the busy holiday shopping season. Employment gains for all of last year were the smallest since 2020, when the coronavirus pandemic put millions of people out of work. For all of last year, employers added less than 600,000 jobs compared to 2 million new jobs the year before. The unemployment rate fell last month to 4.4%. That's partly because tens of thousands of people dropped out of the workforce. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. stocks rose to more records following a mixed report on the U.S. job market today. The S&P 500 climbed 0.6%, topping its all-time high. This is NPR. Lyft and Uber drivers are protesting Waymo's self-driving taxis in San Francisco. They urged state regulators to increase oversight of autonomous vehicles after incidents in which the cars killed pets and blocked traffic. The California Gig Workers Union wants the vehicles removed until safety issues are addressed. Google's parent company, Alphabet, owns Waymo. Scientists are struggling to understand the relationship between climate change and remote parts of the ocean. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports a new study suggests sailboats could help.
The ocean absorbs some carbon dioxide, one of the planet-warming gases that causes climate change. But figuring out exactly how much carbon dioxide the oceans can absorb is very complex. One reason it's so challenging is that there's not a lot of data collected in the Southern Ocean. But sailboats that are competing in round-the-world races do collect measurements of ocean temperature in that region. Scientists in Germany and Belgium found the sailboat data can improve computer models about ocean CO2 absorption. The study was published in the journal Science Advances and recommends even more data collection from sailboats in the future. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
A federal judge has dismissed pioneering hip-hop duo Salt and Peppa's lawsuit to reclaim ownership of their master recordings from Universal Music Group. The court sided with the record label, saying the group never owned the copyrights to their sound recording. UMG argued the recordings were, quote, works made for hire, preventing rights reclamation. I'm Ryland Barton. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Support comes from Watermark Arts Center in downtown Bemidji, featuring exhibits by Indigenous artists in the Mikanan Gallery. The center is accessible and open to all. More at watermarkartcenter.org. Weather tonight, possible snow with less than half an inch accumulation expected. Mostly cloudy with lows 8 to 11 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with highs 14 to 19 degrees.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. President Trump raised eyebrows when he told the New York Times there was only one thing that could stop him on the global stage.
Yeah, there's one thing, my own morality, my own mind.
So what do Americans think about the moral standing of the United States? Well, a new NPR Ipsos poll released today finds Americans still want the U.S. to be a moral leader in the world, but far fewer think it actually is. To make sense of what that means and hear what else Americans told us in this poll, I am joined by NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi there.
Hey, great to be with you.
And senior international affairs correspondent Jackie Northam. Hey, Jackie.
Hi, Mary Louise.
Domenico, just walk us through key findings of this poll. What did we learn?
Well, the survey, we should say, was conducted before the U.S. military action in Venezuela, but it is more about Americans' broader sentiment on foreign policy, and it shows some really notable shifts from a similar survey conducted nearly a decade ago. On the question of moral leadership, like you were talking about, 61% say the U.S. should be the world's moral leader, but only 39% think that it actually is, and that's down sharply from 60% in 2017. One more point, there's a seeming contradiction that stood out to me among Republicans thinking about Venezuela here. Two-thirds of them say that the U.S. should not hesitate to use military force, but 56% say that the U.S. should stay out of the affairs of other countries. So it's a warning sign for Trump going forward on Venezuela. His party's rank and file are seemingly fine with military action, might not be okay with running the country long-term.
Wow, some really interesting shifts from a decade ago. Okay, that's how Americans view this moment. Jackie, what about everyone else? How is the world looking at, say, America's involvement in Venezuela?
Well, I talked to a number of analysts in the UK, France, and in India just to get a sense of how the Venezuela operation was being viewed. And, you know, there was muted reactions from a lot of governments, in part because leaders don't want to annoy Trump. But people in many countries are very worried, not only about the disrespect for international law, but more broadly, is where does this stop? Trump is talking about acquiring Greenland, even by force, threatening Cuba, Colombia, Mexico. I spoke with Sylvie Kaufman, and she's a foreign affairs columnist at Le Monde in Paris, and she said that's a real concern for people.
There's quite a lot of emotion about this when you hear people on the radio. They are worried. They say, but what is next? You know, can they really invade Greenland? What will happen? What should we do? Are we going to send troops there?
And of course, Mary Louise, allies are wondering if relations with the U.S., you know, alliances such as NATO, will hold up if something does happen in Greenland.
Say more about that, Jackie. Beyond Greenland, beyond Venezuela, how allies are trying to navigate relations with the U.S.?
It's a real challenge. It has throughout, you know, this first term. It seems if a country does something Trump doesn't like, he'll retaliate, like with increased tariffs or sanctions. I spoke with Pratap Mehta, and he's a senior fellow at the Center for Policy Research in Delhi. And he says at the beginning of Trump's second term, a lot of leaders thought this action was simply transactional. He's after resources or money. But Mehta says a year on, they see there's something else driving Trump's actions.
It's actually quite remarkable how much he seems to believe that part of the problem with America's relations with the world is that America had actually not exercised its power correctly. Quite extraordinary. And I think the rest of the world is beginning to see that.
And that's led to a real erosion of trust in the U.S., Mehta says. You know, in fact, two of the people I talked with used the term enemy.
Yeah, it's really remarkable to hear, you know, people using the term enemy. You know, domestically, half say that the U.S. has lost influence worldwide in this survey, while 57% say China, who's also seen as the leader in technological development, has gained it.
Domenico, on that, do we know how much is specific to President Trump, how much this reflects things being viewed through the partisan lens in this very partisan moment?
Yeah, really a lot. I mean, when you look inside those numbers, almost 3/4 of Democrats and 6 in 10 independents think the U.S. has lost influence around the world, compared to just 1/4 of Republicans who think so, too. Just like with so many things in U.S. society, things are viewed through this lens of Trump, whether it's the economy or here we're talking about foreign policy. And we see that show up in this survey on everything from military intervention, American moral standing, whether the U.S. should give humanitarian aid to other countries, whether the U.S. should prioritize democracy and human rights, or thinking about Venezuela again, whether foreign policy should focus on enriching America and Americans.
Yeah, stay with what you just raised about democracy and human rights and whether American foreign policy should focus on prioritizing that versus enriching Americans. What does the survey say?
Well, on whether foreign policy should focus on enriching the country, 2/3 of Republicans say it should, compared to just 29% of Democrats and less than half of independents who said that. Promoting democracy and human rights are more of a priority, again, for Democrats now. And that's something Trump seems to have shifted quite a bit from the way the GOP used to talk about international intervention.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that long ago that Republicans were talking about the need for the U.S. to spread democracy and counter communism, to tout freedoms and voting. But in this survey, only 16% of Republicans say that those things should be the priorities, compared to a majority of Democrats. Instead, it's way more transactional for Republicans.
Just fascinating. Okay, so big picture question, I'll throw it to both of you. How should we think about where U.S. foreign policy may go from here? Domenico, you first.
Seems very much in flux. You know, we've seen Trump upend the post-World War II world order. He's moving towards something that is more about regional and hemispheric strength, an idea that really dates back to colonialism. And he's been able to convince his base that this is the way to go, in part because Americans don't care as much about foreign policy compared to, say, the economy as a voting issue. This survey, for example, found 61% say that they follow domestic politics at least fairly closely, compared to just 43% who say the same of international affairs. So after events like Venezuela, the messaging to a domestic audience is so key, because certainly Trump's base is convincible.
And Jackie?
Trump certainly is embracing force to advance U.S. national security interests and likely feels pretty confident after what appears to be a successful military operation in Venezuela. But, you know, I spoke with Michael Cox, and he's a professor of international relations at the London School of Economics, and he says Trump could be too confident.
There's a danger now, it seems to me, of the classical overreach, of hubris, to use the old fantastic Greek word, and that's not going to do anybody any good. It therefore becomes a rather dangerous moment.
You know, Mary Louise, Cox says none of Trump's ambitions are a given. You know, there are many things, including domestic problems, that could undermine Trump's actions.
NPR's Jackie Northam and Domenico Montanaro, thanks to you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.
And for more on NPR's coverage of the changing world order, you can put world reordering in your search engine.
6 months ago, floods swept through Texas Hill Country. At least 130 people died, including 27 campers and counselors at Camp Mystic. Most campers were 8 or 9 years old.
6 months has felt like eternity, and at the same time, I'm frozen on July 4th, and the world keeps spinning, but I'm still there waiting for my daughter to come home. I'm Stacy Stevens, and my daughter is Mary Barrett Stevens.
To keep their daughter's memories alive, family members created a foundation called Heavens 27.
It's our way of carrying our daughter's legacies forward and sharing their light with as many people as possible. I'm Cole Naylor. My daughter is Wynn Naylor.
The foundation supports causes that each girl cared about.
There are funds that support animals, Christian initiatives, the arts.
All Things Considered's Ava Berger spoke to Stevens and Naylor and asked them to describe, in their own words, how the foundation carries on their daughter's legacies.
Mary Barrett was our oldest of three. I'm going to cry. She was the kid that, you know, you walk into a room and you look at her and you're just so proud that she's yours. She's just truly pure joy.
What I would say about Wynn is her imagination is just absolutely limitless. And one of the things I miss most is, hey, Daddy, I have a question. Every night at bedtime, I would finish reading her books. And right about the time I had her door closed and was about to walk downstairs, I got a, hey, Daddy, I have a question.
There was never no. That was never a word in her vocabulary. You know, do you want to try basketball? Do you want to try golf? It was always yes. And then second, Mary Barrett every summer would set up a lemonade stand on vacation and raise money for all the dogs and cats.
Wynn loves her community so much. She loves her teachers. You know, she loves her church, her dance programs. And we want to be able to give back to each one of those organizations that just shaped Wynn.
We are supporting a program that brings youth to the mountains for a week in the summer so that they can experience the outdoors and, you know, the peace of the mountains that Mary loves so much.
I mean, this is a pain I wouldn't wish on anyone. We'll continue to support each other to live the way that our girls lived. You know, just take joy in as many small moments and really give you a full life like they lived. I mean, these are girls who were only on this world for 8 or 9 years. And it is a way of living I will carry with me for the rest of my life.
You know, as a mom, you serve your children daily in different capacities. And to lose that, you feel lost. And these foundations are a way for us to feel like we can still be their mom and serve them and work for them and do things for them. And we haven't lost that piece of it.
They were going to do such big things and make such an impact on the world. And we can't snuff that light out. They're going to continue to impact the world in such a positive way.
That was Cole Naylor and Stacy Stevens remembering their daughters, Wynn Naylor and Mary Barrett Stevens.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingel. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from this date. The History of Jazz airs Saturdays at noon and Sundays at 4 with host Paul Kivi, exploring the distinctly American art form. And tune in Sundays at 6 p.m. with volunteer host at Jazz on America Avenue. Now it's time for your Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer.
On today's date, January 9th, 1987, the chickadees are singing their Phoebe song. This is a couple of days before the average date, which is the 14th of January. The earliest I ever heard chickadees singing Phoebe songs were on the 16th of December in 2007, and the latest was February 3rd, 1985. The chickadees begin this song in hopes that spring will be coming along before too long. This is a song of courtship and a song of hormonal activity, which indicates that the chickadees are getting ready to separate out of the flock and form pair bonds.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Odoo, maker of business management software, with the goal of promoting growth and scaling businesses with efficiency. Learn more about Odoo at odoo.com. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The NFL playoffs begin tomorrow, and for the first time in what feels like forever, there is no runaway favorite for the Super Bowl. And here with me now to give us a preview is NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan. Hi there.
Hey, Juana.
Becky, I have a lot of feelings about all of this, clearly, but I'll just ask you to start us off. Give us a sense of just how wide open things are.
Well, here's a stat for you. So four of the six top seeds in this playoff missed the playoffs entirely last year. So that's the New England Patriots, the Seattle Seahawks, the Chicago Bears, and the Jacksonville Jaguars. Also the top seed in the AFC, the Denver Broncos, haven't won a playoff game in like a decade. Yeah, I think it's wide open. And then I think, as you know, Juana, the Kansas City Chiefs and quarterback Patrick Mahomes had made it to the AFC Championship game for seven straight seasons. And they have missed the playoffs entirely this year. So the AFC side, I think, especially feels very wide open. And then on the NFC side, there's a bunch of new teams in the playoffs. The Philadelphia Eagles, who won the Super Bowl last year, don't look anything, like the juggernaut that they were then. I think it's anybody's guess what happens.
Indeed. Okay, let's just tally it up. There's no Patrick Mahomes, no Joe Burrow, no Lamar Jackson. So Who are the quarterbacks to watch?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's going to be really fun is to watch some really exciting players make their playoff debut. On the NFC side, you have the Chicago Bears, who, of course, are led by quarterback Caleb Williams. Then you have the Patriots, who have Drake May, who has looked great this season, might win MVP. These were the number one and the number three draft picks in the 2024 NFL draft, and they clearly just needed a season to sort of get their feet underneath them. But now, you know, they're looking great, and they're going to lead their – I think both of these teams – you know, really are serious contenders. And then I think not exactly a new face, but shout out to the Jacksonville Jaguars in this conversation. They are arguably the hottest team in the NFL right now, Juana. They've won eight straight games to end the regular season. Mm-hmm. And their quarterback, Trevor Lawrence, he was drafted back in 2021, first overall. He was hailed then as sort of the next great quarterback who could transform a franchise. But it hasn't been that. It's been a bumpy ride for the Jags. They have been pretty bad for much of his tenure there. But they have a new head coach this year, this guy Liam Cohen, who has turned things around suddenly, especially in the second half of the season. Lawrence has looked like the guy that he always had the promise to be, and so I was listening to him give a press conference this week, and he admitted that it turns out it's a lot more fun to win than it is to lose.
You know, we're all very fortunate to play this game, and it is a fun game, and it's awesome, and don't get me wrong, but the fun part is having that success as a team. Like, that's why you play, you know. I mean, all the other stuff's great too, the money and all the other benefits of it, but the reason why you play is to win as a team and to put all this work in to collectively do something together.
All right, Becky, tell us what you think. Who could win the whole thing?
Well, I think don't count out the Jags. They're a little spicy. But I think the Los Angeles Rams are probably the most complete team in this playoff, which is actually kind of crazy to say because they're actually a wild card team. Mm-hmm. They're the five seed. But just all year long, they have been so steady on offense. They're thrilling to watch. They have Matthew Stafford, who's 37 years old, but also put up an MVP quality season, throwing to wide receivers like Puka Nacua, Devontae Adams. These guys are so good. Their defense is great, too. But they will actually face the Panthers, the Carolina Panthers, in the first round. This is a team that sounds like they should easily beat, but they just lost to them not all that long ago. So that's kind of a tricky one. I'm also really intrigued by the Seattle Seahawks. They're the number one seed in the NFC. They have an amazing defense. They also have an incredible wide receiver in Jackson Smith-Njigba, who just like pops off the TV screen when you watch him. They also have a big wild card, though, which is their quarterback, Sam Darnold. He played for the Minnesota Vikings last year and sort of like wilted under the pressure of the hot spotlight in the biggest moments of the year, including in the playoffs. I think Seahawks fans are probably a little nervous about that. The other team I want to mention is the Buffalo Bills. I think fans of the Bills have got to be sweating some bullets because if their amazing quarterback Josh Allen can't lead them to a Super Bowl appearance now that the Chiefs aren't standing in their way, Juana, things might have to change up there.
Indeed. NPR's Becky Sullivan, thank you.
You're welcome.
The thriller Dead Man's Wire dramatizes a real hostage incident from the 1970s. Critic Bob Mondello says director Gus Van Sant's film seems to speak across the decades.
On February 8, 1977, Indianapolis businessman Tony Caritsis walked into the office of his mortgage company and handed its president, Richard Hall, what looked at first like a property site plan. It was actually a diagram of a shotgun with a wire attached.
Wait, hang on a second. Now you turn around.
Tony, played by Bill Skarsgård, is holding a gun.
I'm going to wire this here shotgun to your neck.
Tony, you don't want to do that.
This company's done me wrong. So I'm going to let the world know what you and your dad have done to me. Simple as that.
He places the wire around Hall's throat and makes it taut so that any strong movement...
Tony, what is this?
...will pull the trigger.
This here, Dick, is a dead man's wire. If you faint, stumble, or try to run, this will blow your head off.
Now listen, Tony. No one's seen us. Okay, you've made your point.
I'm just getting started.
Indeed, he is. He calls the police, explains what he's done, then parades Hall, played by an increasingly panicked Dacre Montgomery, out on the street where there are not just cops, but a TV feature reporter who's just gotten very lucky.
What's going on? I'm hearing a robbery.
It looked like a white guy strapped a shotgun to another white guy's head.
A shotgun?
I heard the name of the apartment complex that they're going to.
What apartment complex?
Show you on camera, and you'll let me report some real news for once. How about that?
Everybody's fed up, which suits Caritsis, who is determined, despite the title of the then-popular song, that this revolution will be televised.
Is this on air?
No, but it's being recorded.
These days it can seem as if cell phone cameras and the web are what make instant celebrity possible. Caritsis marshaled the public's attention before that tech existed, like the guy who a couple of years earlier had shouted Attica in Dog Day Afternoon, which this film resembles quite a bit. And that attention was the point. Caritsis didn't just want his money back, he wanted a public apology. And when Richard talks on the phone to his dad, the mortgage company's fat cat founder, played by Al Pacino, you realize what a crazy dream that is.
Apologize for what exactly, Richard?
Well, you know, possibly setting up a deal that wasn't in his interest.
He's saying he knows that we were purposely waiting him out and defrauding him, and he wants to hear you admit that and say you're sorry.
Okay. He has a gun to your neck, son. Why are we the ones apologizing?
Well, you have that Stockholm syndrome setting in you already?
Filmmaker Gus Van Sant makes all of this crackle both with tension and with comic energy, especially with a smooth local radio guy Tony listens to.
I'm DJ Fred Temple.
Played by Coleman Domingo, Fred gets dragged in just as he's heading home for the day.
Good night, my brothers.
Mr. Temple?
Yeah.
Sir, you have a caller?
I have dinner in 30 minutes is what I have, James.
We vetted it with the operator, confirmed and everything. And,
brother, one day you're going to understand that when you have a wife, dinner at 6:45 means dinner at 6:45, not 7 o'clock, definitely not 6:30, and absolutely not 6:46.
He's asking to speak to you? The guy with the shotgun in the man's neck?
Temple stops the elevator doors from closing.
You should open with that, James.
Public attention, of course, can be fleeting. Caritsis sees himself, with some justification, as a common man standing up to a system rigged against folks like him.
These people betrayed me. They set me up and schemed to ruin my life.
If his feelings resonate today, it's because Van Sant has taken pains to make Dead Man's Wire not just briskly entertaining, but a timely reminder that when everyday folks get sold the American dream, there's often fine print that keeps it just out of reach. I'm Bob Mandela.
The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from...
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Happy Dancing Turtle invites all ages to participate in their winter bingo scavenger hunt now until January 15th. Look for 24 items on your bingo card with a special focus on animal tracks. Find a registration link and more details at happydancingturtle.com. And we receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. Elder Circle in Grand Rapids has monthly support groups for caregivers at various times and locations. Find a full schedule at eldercircle.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribes are raising concerns about ICE activity and the safety of their tribal citizens living in the Twin Cities after 37-year-old Renee Good was fatally shot by an ICE agent Wednesday in South Minneapolis. The Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, White Earth Nation, Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, and Red Lake Nation have issued releases expressing remorse for Good and her family. A number of Native groups have also extended their condolences, including the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition and Native Women Running. The restaurant Owamni by sous chef Sean Sherman in Minneapolis closed after the shooting. In a social media post, it said it will reopen with a portion of sales this weekend being donated to Good's family. Tribes are encouraging their citizens to report any interactions with ICE to them. To be mindful of their surroundings, carry identification, including tribal IDs, and to check in on elders and relatives in the Twin Cities. The Red Lake Nation is condemning the shooting, saying President Trump must be held accountable for his, quote, war of retribution, and that it has 8,000 members living in the Twin Cities where, quote, ICE is presently terrorizing residents. The Trump administration is justifying the shooting while city and state leaders disagree. The mayor wants ICE to get out of Minneapolis, and so does Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, who's White Earth. On national television during an interview with ABC News Thursday night, Flanagan said, it's time for ICE to get out of Minnesota, to leave them alone, and that enough is enough. Meanwhile, in South Dakota, the Oglala Sioux tribe is also raising concerns about its tribal citizens living in the Twin Cities. In an advisory to tribal citizens, OST President Frank Starr comes out said he has been made aware that ICE detained 4 of their tribal members in Minneapolis. He said tribal attorneys have been instructed to reach out to Flanagan and work toward their release. The advisory to Oglala Lakota citizens also includes how to handle ICE interactions and to contact Starr comes out or other officials with the tribe immediately. A Portland organization involved with missing and murdered Indigenous people awareness and advocacy is holding volunteer training. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports on what people should expect should they participate in MMIP events.
For roughly a year and a half, MMIW Search and Hope Alliance has conducted searches and events that support their community. Founder Kimberly Linning says they rely heavily on volunteers to get things done across the region. Besides being physically fit for hiking, marches, and distributing materials, Linning says it's also important that people are emotionally mature and tough.
How they handle stress, how they handle dealing with confrontation, because a lot of times we're dealing with devastated families. Sometimes their anger can be directed at us, and it's not personal. It's because the families are under so much pressure.
Linning says a common misperception is that volunteering with groups like hers is some kind of true crime adventure, or that all they do is search for bodies. She says most MMIP cases result in finding people who are alive, but even then, there can be challenging situations.
A lot of times, they're struggling from an addiction, so we kind of look at that aspect. Hey, do you need to get into detox? Would you like to go here? Do you want to speak to your family? We really encourage the missing that we find to call home, call their family, and we offer to give them that resource.
Volunteers with special skills such as scuba diving, rappelling, or operating drones are great, Linning adds. The MMIW Search and Hope Alliance's training will be held in Gresham, Oregon on January 10th. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Skuktash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Nye.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. For more than 20 million Americans, January 1st brought way more expensive health insurance. These are people who received expanded federal subsidies to help cover health care plans purchased on the Affordable Care Act marketplace or Obamacare. Congress did not renew those subsidies for 2026, so on average, premium costs for ACA plans are double what they were last year. Now, there is some news on this we want to tell you about. Yesterday, the House voted to renew those currently expired subsidies, but it's unclear where that might go in the Senate and what President Trump would sign. In the meantime, we have reached one of those 20 million plus people. Her name is Jamie Israel. She is a therapist in Atlanta and joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. Jamie, let's start with this. What were you paying for health care last year compared to what you pay now without the federal subsidies?
I had a gold plan last year, mm-hmm. so I was right around $560 a month. This year, I'm looking at a $940 monthly premium, and that is without any subsidies.
I mean, just doing the math, you're paying nearly $400 more a month for your health care. That is not a small increase. Is that something you can afford?
That's a great question. That's what I'm trying to figure out. Previously, when I decided on this plan for 2026, it seemed feasible to find a way to work it into my budget one way or another. And as I've continued to run my numbers, it's not looking like that's going to be available to me. So I am looking at some alternative plans for the year, trying to see if I can switch my plan before the January 15th deadline.
If you do end up changing your plan, what would that mean for your coverage? Would a cheaper plan, as far as you know, still cover everything that you need for your care?
Oh, not even close. No, the coverage tanks substantially. Part of what I've been wrestling with is you can pay less in monthly premium, but get almost next to no reasonable coverage versus paying a relatively exorbitant amount and getting mediocre coverage.
I know that you're a licensed therapist, so you're also a healthcare provider facing those cost increases on that end, that's right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Have you seen patients who are affected by these expiring subsidies?
Absolutely. Subsidies have certainly been an issue for some of my clients, and they have had to make changes in their healthcare coverage, which is affecting our ability to continue our work together. I am making accommodations for the clients that I'm working with who've been affected and are facing a lack of access to treatment. In other words, reducing my rate and getting paid less so that my clients can be cared for. But it's a tricky balance trying to be accommodating to the people who need my care and also keeping an eye on my bottom line and making sure that I don't go into the red.
We've heard from our colleagues on Capitol Hill that the Senate's working on some kind of compromise to extend the subsidies, though, of course, it's very unclear how that might resolve, given that this issue already caused a government shutdown. Jamie, what do you want Congress to hear as they continue to negotiate this?
What I would want them to hear is the desperation that I'm hearing not only from the clients that I work with, but also from colleagues in my field, other peers and friends and acquaintances that I know. This is really dire. This is having very real consequences on people's lives, and people's health is at stake. I essentially plead with Congress to represent the populations that they're here to serve.
Jamie Israel, she's a therapist in Atlanta and receives her health care through the Affordable Care Act marketplace. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
The prosecution of former Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro could take years because it raises so many complex legal questions. One of them is whether government leaders deserve immunity. NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson reports.
At his first court appearance in New York this week, Nicolas Maduro told the judge he's still the president of Venezuela, even though he was seized and sent to the U.S. to face narco-terrorism and cocaine trafficking charges. Maduro says he's innocent, and his lawyer signaled he'll argue Maduro should be shielded from prosecution because of his leadership role overseas. Ingrid Brunk is an international law professor at Vanderbilt University.
In domestic U.S. practice, there is a doctrine called head of state immunity, and head of states are entitled to immunity from suit of almost all kinds.
Brunk studies immunity around the world, and she says there are some good policy reasons for it.
And this kind of immunity plays this really important function of facilitating diplomatic interaction. It allows foreign leaders to travel to the United States. It allows our leaders to travel abroad without the fear of arrest or prosecution or even civil lawsuits.
In Maduro's case, U.S. officials say he does not deserve a golden shield. They call him a fugitive from justice who was not elected freely or fairly. Here's President Trump at a news conference after the arrest.
The illegitimate dictator Maduro was the kingpin of a vast criminal network responsible for trafficking colossal amounts of deadly and illicit drugs into the United States.
But in a social media post, Trump also called Maduro the president of Venezuela. Erwin Chemerinsky's dean at the UC Berkeley School of Law.
The court is going to have to decide whether or not Maduro was the head of state. And part of the evidence that Maduro will point to is Donald Trump referring him as the president of Venezuela. And there's no doubt that he exercised all of the powers and all of the trappings of the office.
Chemerinsky says the Maduro case is unusual. Strongman Manuel Noriega of Panama never officially served as that country's president. So when he was arrested by the U.S. and transported here for trial in 1990, his arguments were weaker than the ones Maduro will make.
There's not a case in the past with facts like these. It's really going to be a question of first impression.
U.S. Supreme Court precedent gives the American president a lot of leeway over foreign policy, including which governments to recognize. And that could be a big hurdle for Maduro's bid for immunity in an American courtroom. Again, Ingrid Brunk.
The problem is for him that the president has the power to decide who actually is a head of state and who is not.
But Brunk says Maduro may have a stronger argument when it comes to another kind of immunity, the kind that covers official acts. Parts of the Maduro indictment allege he ordered violence against people who owed him drug money, a red line with no connection to his government role. Other parts of the court papers are not so clear, she says.
Some of the things in the indictment, like using the military to facilitate flights, that's the kind of conduct for which we would typically say someone would receive official immunity.
If that concept, official acts, sounds familiar, there's a good reason why. 2 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court gave President Trump and future presidents near absolute immunity from prosecution for official actions they take as part of their jobs. The High Court was interpreting the Constitution and the president's Article II power to declare Trump immune from many criminal charges. Maduro's bid for immunity relies on a different legal doctrine, one that could be trumped by the executive power the president has asserted and the Supreme Court has blessed. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Millions of Americans are expected to lose federal food benefits in the next few years as states implement new Republican requirements for SNAP. But for many who need this food, hunger is not political, it's visceral. And the health effects can last for years. Karen Brown of New England Public Media reports.
How many items did you say?
Three.
Marilyn Vargas is pushing a grocery cart at a food bank in East Hampton, Massachusetts.
So I have a pack of breast chicken, cookies, Cheerios.
Her household of six needs this food. She says their only income is her disability check, and when the federal government delayed November's SNAP benefits during the shutdown.
Yes, I was very worried because I don't get enough money.
Fresh in her mind is the time before she moved to this area when she couldn't afford any food because transportation to her job fell through.
Well, I felt terrible. I was crying. I was desperate. The only food I had, I gave it to my kids.
This is what hunger looks like in the U.S., says Mariana Chilton, a UMass Amherst public health professor. It's not the stereotype that many people imagine.
They think, oh, there couldn't possibly be hunger in America, because the way that we know that that exists is because children have distended bellies and flies in their eyes or look visibly malnourished.
In reality, Chilton says, hunger can show up in many ways, like school kids' behavior.
They can't focus. They may be more likely to get in fights with their peers or not be able to listen.
In babies, she says, even short-term hunger can affect the brain. They're growing hundreds of neurons a second and need fuel to interact with the world.
Even just 1 or 2 days of reduced intake is going to affect their cognitive, social, and emotional development.
Mary Cowie is a retired teacher in Western Massachusetts. She can attest to the lasting scars of hunger. Cowie grew up on Long Island in a family of 10 with only her father's salary as a teacher. She says they survived largely on potatoes and surplus shark given to them by a local fisherman.
We were glad to have the shark and potatoes because there were some times when we didn't have the shark and potatoes.
She remembers the pain of an empty belly, jealousy over classmates' lunches, and competing for food at the table.
It was not uncommon for my sister to like reach over and take something off my plate. So we learned to eat really fast.
Only the youngest siblings got milk, and Cowie remembers getting her first school physical in fourth grade.
And I remember the nurse letting me read the scale, you know, when you'd push the thing across, and it was 40 pounds.
She was 9. Cowie is now 65. After a series of broken bones, she was diagnosed with severe osteoporosis. She blames an early lack of calcium. Her bones are so brittle, her doctor says another fall could disable her. And even though she hasn't gone without food in decades, Cowie still describes herself as an opportunistic eater. When she sees food, she eats it.
There's this mentality of like, in case there's not food tomorrow. For me, that never went away.
Conservative politicians often claim fraud in the SNAP program as a reason to limit benefits. Marilyn Vargas, leaving the food bank with a full cart, has another theory.
I don't think they've never been hungry, exactly. Especially Trump, he's never been hungry because his father was rich.
In 2023, 13% of American households were considered food insecure by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. There is no public data after that because the Trump administration has canceled the annual survey. For NPR News, I'm Karen Brown in Western Massachusetts.
This story comes from NPR's partnership with New England Public Media and KFF Health News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE, People Powered Radio. My name is Andrew DeZingle. Listen Saturdays at 2 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. for She Rose Radio with Carmel Holt, amplifying female voices in music. This week, a celebration of Joan Baez's 85th birthday on January 9th with an encore interview at the 2024 Newport Folk Festival, a meaningful return for the 65th anniversary of both the festival and Joan's debut performance in 1969, which immediately launched her career. The Minnesota Discovery Center in Hibbing hosts a screening of Season 6 premiere, All Creatures Great and Small, on Saturday, January 10th from 1 to 3 p.m. Grand Rapids Players presents Insomniacs, Saturday, January 10th at 7 p.m. in the Ives Studio Theater at the Rife Center. See several short scenes which have been written within the past 24 hours. Northland Arboretum in Baxter offers forest ice skating during daylight hours. Explore a gently winding trail through the woods with light elevation changes. Limited skate sizes are available to rent on a first-come, first-served basis. They are still looking for donations of kids and men's sizes of skates. Kotaska Community Action offers free community meals on Mondays from 4 to 6 p.m. and lunch every Wednesday from 11 to 1 at their Circles of Support office, located across from Treasure Bay Printing on Northeast 4th Street in Grand Rapids. They also offer a food pantry from 11 to 2, Monday through Thursday. The Buck Lake Improvement Club has their monthly breakfast buffet this Sunday from 9 to noon at their community center 12 miles north of Nashwauk on Highway 65. Enjoy a blizzard of flavors. And the Sac-Sim Bog near Meadowlands has a snowshoe hike this Sunday from 9 to 1, exploring the Sac's Wildlife Management Area. Register in advance at saczim.org. Now back to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
I'm Scott Detrow, and I am joined by Emily Kwong and Burley McCoy of NPR's science podcast, Shortwave, for our science news roundup. Hey there.
Hi.
Hi, Scott.
You have, as you often do, brought us three stories that caught your attention this week. Let's hear where they are.
A galaxy cluster so hot it shocked researchers.
How elephants' trunks lead them to food.
And a big discovery in butterfly migration.
When I have the option of starting with a hot galaxy cluster, it's always going to be that.
Wow.
Let's start off. What would you say a galaxy cluster is, though? Let's start there.
Exactly what it sounds like. It is a collection of galaxies, but kind of like a city where each galaxy is a different building. Our galaxy, the Milky Way, is part of a cluster called the Local Group, for example. But the galaxy cluster we want to talk about, which is the subject of a new paper in Nature, was formed about 12 billion years ago. And the universe itself is only about 13.8 billion years old.
So that's just a fast billion years, like a snap of the fingers in galaxy terms. Like we're talking about this was a baby in galactic years.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And current theories say that younger galaxy clusters should be relatively cool. But this one is very hot, like hotter than the surface of the sun. Huh. We talked to Jorge Moreno, an astrophysicist who didn't work on the paper, and he made an analogy to U.S. history. He said, if you go back a few centuries, you expect to see little buildings and horses and carriages, not a modern metropolis.
Like it's late 1700s and a city looks like Las Vegas.
This galaxy cluster is popping. It's far hotter than scientists expected to find at this early point in the universe.
Do researchers have any idea why it's so hot?
We don't know why yet, but one of the study authors, Daji Joe, says it is the first time a galaxy cluster this hot has been detected at such a young age.
And this cluster also contains active galaxies. Three of them have supermassive black holes at the center, which is also surprising given the cluster's age.
So this forces us to rethink our current understanding of how these large structures form and evolve in the universe.
Although, Scott, it is possible that this cluster is an extreme case, so we need more data.
I have a lot of other questions that I will keep Googling, but for now, we are going to move forward to another topic, though, because we've got a lot to talk about, and we got to talk about elephants.
Really good.
Thank you. Listeners don't see that I flared my hand like a trunk. But the trunks are what we're talking about, right?
Yes, big time. At the very tip of an elephant trunk are two nostrils powered by nearly 2,000 olfactory genes, which is five times more than a human has, and over twice as many as dogs.
Which makes me think if you need to sniff something out, hire an elephant, not a dog.
True.
Yeah, and if you do, pay them fairly in what they love, grass, leaves, because elephants eat hundreds of pounds of plants a day. They are constantly making food decisions about whether to stay foraging in a patch or travel in search of a better one. And Adrian Schrader at the University of Pretoria wanted to know how their noses guide them in the wild.
Animals don't just randomly walk across the landscape and hope to find food. And so our question really was an idea of, well, do they use the amount of food as a cue?
Yeah, and to test this, Adrian's team built a giant maze for elephants shaped like a Y with walls over 7 feet tall. So picture one entrance, two paths with different quantities of food at either end.
So it's like choosing almost between like two different Las Vegas buffets, not being able to see which one was bigger.
Exactly. Four captive elephants took on this challenge. From the maze entrance, the food was about 30 feet away, so way beyond the reach of their trunks. They couldn't see because the walls were so tall. And every time, they chose the path with more food.
Mm.
Unless the quantity difference was less than 600 grams, which is about 6 to 10 trunk loads of grass. And then they tended to pick either route, which suggests they couldn't smell the difference or they just didn't care. These results were published in the journal Biology Letters.
And Alvaro Lopez Quegoya, who was not part of the study, found the elephant's ability to discriminate food quantities remarkable. Though he points out there are a lot more smells in the wild than in the preserve where these captive elephants lived.
This is really interesting. I'm curious, like, what is useful about this research?
Well, elephants, while adorable, can damage their environments. They stomp on farmers' crops. They can knock down endangered trees. But if researchers understand elephants' use of smell, maybe they can cover plants with bad odors to protect them from hungry elephants.
All right, so let's go from a very large animal to a very small one. Let's talk butterflies, specifically butterfly migration. What's surprising about it?
Yeah, so this is a migration in painted lady butterflies. They have similar coloring to monarchs, but they're smaller. They're super widespread, and they have the longest migration of any butterfly. And scientists found something striking in that migration, that depending on if they live in the northern or southern hemisphere, they follow completely opposite migration paths. Essentially, the equator is acting as a migration barrier for these two isolated populations.
Okay, I'm gonna be honest here. This doesn't particularly surprise me, right? The seasons are opposite. This makes sense. Why is it a big deal?
Fair, but this is the first time a migration barrier has been described for any insect. And to study this, researchers collected more than 300 butterflies from 38 countries across the northern and southern hemispheres.
We talked to Aurora García Berro from the Botanical Institute of Barcelona, and she says their team looked at the butterflies' genes for months, searching for clues about what made these two populations distinct. And then one day, she found something really weird.
And I actually thought it was an artifact, but then I showed it to my colleague, and they were like completely surprised, like, you don't know, this is so exciting.
And this dramatic, what was it?
Yeah, they found that a large chunk of DNA in the southern hemisphere butterflies was completely flipped. It was oriented the other way than the same DNA chunk in the northern hemisphere butterflies. And this chunk contains genes involved in migration.
Whoa.
So what they think they're seeing is one species that separated into two populations, and now their genetics are diverging too because of these different migration pathways. And this is sort of a lens into how a single species might split into two across a migration barrier. And it might explain why we see closely related species in different hemispheres. Mm. They published the results in the journal Nature Communications.
That is really interesting. What is the thinking on the larger significance of this?
Well, painted lady butterflies, while small, make up a huge biomass. In 2017, a 70-mile stretch of these butterflies blocked weather radar in Colorado. They can affect agriculture, pollination, and the health of other species. So Aurora says identifying how animals migrate is important to understanding the health of that species, yes, but also the health of all the places that species travels.
That was Emily Kwong, along with Burley McCoy from NPR science podcast Shortwave, which you can follow on the NPR app or other podcasting apps for new scientific discoveries. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds, working to maximize the impact of charitable giving and to create customized philanthropic solutions. Learn more at fjc.org. From Imaginable Futures, funding programs in the U.S. with the goal of ensuring young children and their parents get the education they need to thrive. Learn more at imaginablefutures.com. From the University of Maryland Libraries, committed to reimagining learning, advancing the public good, and empowering research that creates a better future for everyone. More at lib.umd.edu. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. We receive support from North Homes Children and Family Services, providing compassionate mental health services to children and families at home, school, and in the community. More information at NorthHomes.org. Central Lakes College Music Program has a meet and greet Monday, January 12th from noon to 2 in the Music Hall on the Brainerd campus. There are optional auditions for the program's ensembles during this time, and you don't have to be a student to join them. Looking at weather tonight, possible snow with less than half an inch accumulation expected. Mostly cloudy with lows 8 to 11 degrees. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with highs 14 to 19 degrees. Blustery northwest winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Evening lows 0 to 8 degrees. And Sunday, partly sunny with highs 21 to 25.
I think most people